And now our speaker for today is Herb Ogden.
I have two topics. The first topic, April Fool and Practical Jokes, has to do with the UU first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. It can be hard to maintain one's dignity while unwittingly being made a fool of in public. How can we have fun without inflicting lasting damage? The second topic, hoaxes, can also relate to being fooled in public, but being fooled privately is also a problem, and it can be a much worse problem. Hoaxes always have to do with the UUA's fourth principle, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. It also has to do with the fifth of our six sources, which is humanist teachings, which counsel us to heed the guidance of reason and the results of science, and warn us against idolatries of the mind and spirit. Now, a really good service might range from the sublime to the ridiculous. I have set my sights lower. I intend to go from the occasionally serious to the mildly funny. I hope my opening words about the history of the church organ were an example of the latter. To begin with, what's the origin of April Fool? Let's be clear. April Fool's Day is not a religious holiday. It's not any kind of holiday except in Odessa in the Ukraine. I won't get into why that is. It may, however, have gotten an unintended boost from a pope. In 1582, Pope Gregory XIII decreed the adoption of the Gregorian calendar, named after himself, and this apparently hastened a trend away from the medieval custom of celebrating New Year's Day at the end of March. The change was published widely, but some people didn't get the message and continued to celebrate until April 1st. They were ridiculed, and because they were seen as foolish, they were called April Fools. I'm going to wait for my clock to stop striking 11. The French tradition of April Fish, Poisson d'Avril, however, predates this change since it goes back to at least 1508. In French-speaking areas and in Italy, April Fish includes attempting to attach a paper fish to the victim's back without being noticed. Many newspapers also spread a false story on April Fish Day, and a subtle reference to a fish is sometimes given as a clue to the fact that it's a prank. In Poland, Prima Aprilis, 1 April in Latin, is a day of pranks that goes back centuries. Many pranks are played. Hoaxes, sometimes very sophisticated, are prepared by people, the media, which often cooperate to make the information more credible, and even public institutions. Serious activities are usually avoided, and generally every word said on April 1st can be untrue. In fact, back in 1683, the hoax tradition in Poland was so strong that the anti-Turkish alliance that the Kingdom of Poland signed with the Holy Roman Empire on the 1st of April was backdated to the 31st of March, so there'd be no doubt it was serious. Danes, Finns, Icelanders, Norwegians, and Swedes celebrate April Fool's Day. News media outlets will publish exactly one false story on April 1st. For newspapers, this will typically be a first page article, but not the top headline. One more April Fool's story. In a famous prank in 1957, the British Broadcasting Company showed a film in their Panorama Current Affairs program purporting to show Swiss farmers picking freshly grown spaghetti in what they called the Swiss spaghetti harvest. The BBC was soon flooded with requests to purchase a spaghetti plant, and it declared the film a hoax on the news the very next day. Many April Fool's shenanigans are also practical jokes. A practical joke is practical because it consists of someone doing something that is physical, like sticking a fish on someone's back, in contrast to an oral or a written joke. Today's postlude, which of course you haven't heard yet, is an example. By the way, the bit about the postlude reminds me of how our minister emeritus, Paul Bortz, once did an April Fool's service. He did it all backwards, so he began with the postlude, but our postlude comes after the service. Anyway, one definition of a practical joke is a mischievous trick played on someone, generally causing the victim to experience embarrassment, perplexity, confusion, or discomfort. Practical jokes differ from confidence tricks or hoaxes in that the victim soon finds out or is let in on the joke. Practical jokes are usually generally lighthearted without lasting effect. They aim to make the victim feel humbled or foolish, but not victimized or humiliated. I guess calling April Fool as soon as the trick is played is what lets the victims laugh at themselves and graciously restore their dignity. So I would argue that a traditional April Fool practical joke doesn't offend any UU principles, but letting someone walk around in public for an hour with a sign on his back saying, kick me, might be a different matter. Worse yet would be an undisclosed hoax. And that leads me to my second topic. I'll begin my second topic with a story. For that, I need to give you some background. Some of you know that I retired from being a trial lawyer last year. But before I was a lawyer, I was a German teacher for 10 years. And when I switched from using German to using legalese, I say I just changed the foreign language I operated in. I was hired to teach German right after college. It happened by chance. I was interviewed for a history teaching job at a private high school outside Detroit, Michigan. When the headmaster found out I'd spent a year of college in a junior year abroad program at the Ludwig Maximilian University in Munich, he hired me not only to teach German, but to start his German program. I think the fellow he'd originally hired to start the program had quit. I also think the headmaster should have had his head examined for hiring a rookie to start the program. He gave me more than enough rope to hang myself with. Luckily, I was not good at tying nooses. After 4 years at Detroit Country Day School, I decided to get my master's in German to be a better teacher. I did that by spending a summer in Middlebury and a year at the university in Mainz. I was one of about 30 Middlebury students in the program that year. Many of them had spent little or no time in any German-speaking country, few were fluent, and most were younger than I was. So I had the advantage of being fluent and experienced. Also, during the summer in Middlebury, I developed a reputation for knowing more about Germany, especially German history, than anyone else in the program. So the group elected me to represent them while we were at the Johannes Gutenberg Universität in Mainz. Now I've set the stage for what happened when I was taking a walk in a village near the Rhine River with Chuck Ainsworth, who was another American in the Middlebury program. He and his wife lived in that village while he was studying in Mainz. We saw a sign that looked like this. De Vago. He asked, innocently enough, what's that? I replied, that's the famous De Vago site. He said, huh? I said, you know, the famous De Vago cemetery. He said, huh? I said, you know about the De Vago Indians, don't you? He said he'd never heard of them. I said, really, but you live right here. No, he'd never heard of them. I said, well, you know that on Columbus's third or fourth voyage to America, he brought some natives back with him and presented them to King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella. He said, yeah, I read that. I said, yes, and they were from the De Vago tribe. But then I said, you don't know what happened to them? He said, no. I said, well, after a while, Ferdinand and Isabella got bored with them. He said, really? I said, yeah. And Ferdinand traded them to the Archbishop of Mainz in exchange for a bunch of reliquaries. Apparently Spain didn't have as many pieces of saints of the end of the true cross as some other countries, and this was seen as a serious deficit. He said, uh-huh. I said, yeah. And the De Vagos came to live with in the Archbishop's palace, you know, over there next to the cathedral. He said, I didn't know that. I said, yeah, the Archbishop thought they were interesting. But when they were getting older, he decided they should live out their last days not in his palace, but in a more rural setting, more like where they lived in America. Chuck said, "That makes sense." I said, "Yeah. And you know, the Archbishop owned many parcels of land along the Rhine." He said, "Yeah." I said, "So he gave them one of these parcels to live on, and that's where they stayed till they died. And that's where they're buried, in the Divago Cemetery." He said, "That's fascinating." I said, "Actually, Chuck, Divago is a cement company." And it was. Chuck pulled the same prank on his wife the next week. Now, how did I get away with this? It involved getting Chuck to ignore the UUA's fourth principle, which I quoted at the beginning, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. It also has to do with the fifth of the UUA's six sources, humanist teachings which counsel us to heed the guidance of reason and the results of science and warn us against idolatries of the mind and spirit. So why did Chuck believe that some Indians brought back by Columbus wound up buried in a special cemetery in his village in the Rhineland? He accepted as true something that the guidance of reason should have told him wasn't true. Why? Well, to begin with, he heard the story from someone whom he regarded as an expert, namely me. Also, it contained some information he knew was true. Columbus did bring back natives with him on one of those voyages. Reliquaries were hot items centuries ago. And the Archbishop did have a palace in Mainz and many parcels along the Rhine River. Finally, the story was something my friend wanted to believe because the presence of an Indian cemetery made the little village where he lived much more interesting. My Divago tale concerned religion only slightly. Think about the reliquaries and the kindly Archbishop. But bear in mind that there are other tall tales that some people have embraced as a serious part of their religion. Here are just a few examples. You can find more, many more, by Googling something like religion and hoax. And if the pandemic quarantine has left you at such loose ends that you want to spend time on this, one hoax is about a large piece of old linen that bears the image of a man. You'll see there's the front of the man on one side and the back on the other. It has fake blood stains. On LifeScience.com, I found an article called "The Shroud of Turin and Other Holy Relics," which says this about it. And this is the shroud here. Though many believe Italy's Shroud of Turin is the burial shroud of Jesus, there's compelling evidence that the shroud is in fact a hoax, including the 1389 letter from a French bishop to Pope Clement stating that a painter confessed to creating it. Indeed, the bishop's evidence was so convincing that Pope Clement agreed it was a forgery, one of countless faked religious relics circulating at the time. Carbon dating of the shroud showed it revealed it does not date back to the time of Christ, but instead 14 centuries later. Exactly when the forger confessed to making it. Even more damning for its authenticity, there is no record of its existence before then. If it really is the burial shroud of Jesus Christ, it seems suspicious that no one knew anything about it for 1,300 years. As researcher Joe Nickel noted in his book, Relics of the Christ, which appeared in 2007, the shroud on display in Turin is only one of over 40 such Jesus shrouds, all claimed to be the real one. Still, many remain convinced of its authenticity. Another religious hoax is a lost book of the Hebrew Bible, supposedly found by an 8th century Englishman. It's the Lost Book of Jasher. Published in 1750, the title page of the book says, "Translated into English by Flaccus Albinus Altquinus of Britain, abbot of Canterbury, who went on a pilgrimage into the Holy Land and Persia, where he discovered this volume in the city of Gazna." The book claims to be written by Jasher, son of Caleb, one of Moses' lieutenants. The book covers biblical history from the creation down to Jasher's own day. 20th century Rosicrucians considered it an inspired text. Now for the fact check. It appears Alcuinus never went to the Holy Land, let alone to Persia. And why would a Christian back then make a pilgrimage to Persia anyway? And Alcuinus wasn't the abbot of Canterbury. He became the abbot of Tours in France after he left England to serve Charlemagne, the Holy Roman Emperor. The only shred of truth in his story is that the Hebrew Bible does mention a book of Yasher. Nobody has found it yet. Some religious hoaxes are very sinister. A horrifying example is the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, or the Protocols of the Meetings of the Learned Elders of Zion. It's a fabricated text purporting to describe a Jewish plan for global domination. The hoax, which was shown to be plagiarized from several earlier sources, was first published in Russia in 1903, translated into multiple languages, and disseminated internationally in the early part of the 20th century. Henry Ford funded printing of 500,000 copies of this thing that were distributed throughout the United States in the 1920s. In Nazi Germany, distillations of it were assigned to be read by German school children after the Nazis came to power in 1933, even after it had been exposed as fraudulent by the British newspaper, The Times, in 1921, and by the German newspaper, the Frankfurter Zeitung, in 1924. It remains widely available in numerous languages, in print and on the internet, and continues to be presented by neo-fascist, fundamentalist, and anti-Semitic groups as a genuine document. It has been described as probably the most influential work of anti-Semitism ever written. The Protocols purports to document the minutes of a late 19th century meeting attended by world Jewish leaders, the Elders of Zion, who were supposedly conspiring to take over the world. The forgery places in the mouths of the Jewish leaders a variety of plans, most of which derive from older anti-Semitic canards. For example, the protocols include plans to subvert the morals of the non-Jewish world, plans for Jewish bankers to control the world's economies, plans for Jewish control of the press, and ultimately, plans for the destruction of civilization. According to Professor Daniel Pipes, the book's vagueness, almost no names, dates, or issues are specified, has been one key to its wide-ranging success. The purportedly Jewish authorship also helps make the book more convincing. Its embrace of contradictions, that to advance, Jews use all tools available, including capitalism and communism, philo-Semitism and anti-Semitism, democracy and tyranny, make it possible for the protocols to reach out to all, rich and poor, right and left, Christian and Muslim, American and Japanese. So, how do we honor the fourth principle, and make sure that our search for truth is responsible? In general, here's some advice from a UUA blog by Julia Nichols, who was an intern with the UU office at the United Nations for the summer of 2020. She says, in your own life, you can't help to combat the discrediting of you can help to combat the discrediting of journalists by supporting your own local news organization with subscriptions or donations. You might also consider supplementing your news intake with news from organizations with less political bias. Americans consider PBS News to be among the most unbiased and trusted news sources in the US. Additionally, there are steps you can take to avoid being fooled by disinformation and fake news. There are free online fact-checking websites like Snopes and PolitiFact that can help you sort out fact from fiction. When reading news articles online, especially those found on social media, pay close attention to the name of the source and search for its credibility. Some fake news sites have names very similar to reputable sites, like the debunked site abcnews.com.co. None of us is impervious to being fooled by disinformation and fake news, so take care to verify the information you see online. Some particular advice regarding religion is on the website evangelicalpress.com, where I found an article, Don't Fall for These Christian Hoaxes. In it, Bob Passatino, who runs something called Answers in Action, offers several tips for identifying false legends. Use extra caution if the story fits the following characteristics, he warned. And think about how these relate to my Devago hoax. First thing to watch out for is there's no evidence to back it up. He says, sometimes there's no evidence because of the very nature of the story. That doesn't mean such a story can't be true. It just means it's not a story that can be considered trustworthy. Research. At most, it's an illustration or an example. Second thing is, it's so detailed or bizarre, we can't believe someone could make it up. And third, its strongest commendation is that it ought to be true. He says, be careful you are not persuaded to believe a particular story simply because you wish it to be true. This can be a strong temptation, but don't give in to it. God won't excuse us for supporting made-up stories because they serve a useful purpose. Now, because April Fool's is just around the corner, I hope response time will include not only some consideration of horrible hoaxes, but also some stories of lighthearted fun.